Hi, this is Chuck Gunderson, the author of Some Fun Tonight, the backstage story of how the Beatles rocked America, the historic tours, 1964-66. I know it's a long title, but you are listening to the Fab Four Free-for-All.
And welcome to a very exciting edition of the Fab Four Free-for-All. I am your host for today, your moderator, Mitch Axelrod. And joining me, as they always do, are my buddies,
Rob Leonard
and
Tony Triguardo.
I'm sorry, who?
Tony Triguardo.
Oh, I like the way you say Triguardo.
Thank you.
It's just, you know, it sounds, I always go Triguardo.
Nice.
Because you can't pronounce your last name.
Okay.
Anyway, we have on the phone with us a very special guest. He is the author of books that have probably the longest title we've ever seen.
The Chris O'Dell book had
no. Actually, I think this one has it beat.
Okay,
but very, it's well worth it. The title of the books are "Some Fun Tonight: The Backstage Story of How the Beatles Rocked America, the Historic Tours, 1964 through 1966." I have to catch my breath as we welcome author Chuck Gunderson. Welcome, Chuck.
Hey guys, how are you? It's great to be with you. Thanks so much for inviting me. I love your shows. I listen to them every time they're on. So
well, thank you for
doing it.
The check's in the mail.
The hardest working Beatle experts in the business.
Bless you, sir.
I don't know about that.
I can't imagine how much work had to go into these volumes, but we'll get to that.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Now, Chuck, we just want to say your book. I'm going to say book because it's in a slipcase. There are two volumes, volume 164, volume 2, 1965 to 66. They are, first of all, beautiful works of art, the books themselves.
Yes.
So I have to say, even the slipcase, which could have been just black and with the words, are just incredible. So number one, kudos on these 30-pound books. I mean, how much have you ever weighed the books, by the way?
Believe me, I have weighed the books. They are 13 pounds.
Each?
Wow.
Or for the whole?
Well, the whole set. So the two books inside the slipcase is 13 pounds. Plus, it's also in a customized box, so it's easy to ship.
Yeah, it's absolutely. I mean, they're really, when you buy these, and I'm not saying if you buy these, because we'll give you where to get them at the end of the show, but when you buy these, you will not be disappointed. I mean, these books are just works of art. Very akin to the Spicer books, which I know in the acknowledgments you say is your mentor. So first of all, let's talk about Bruce and these books. And how do you research something so vast as 3 years of touring in America?
Well, you know, Bruce was my mentor. I mean, I love Bruce. I have all his books. And I was kind of waiting for Bruce to do this book. And every time I'd see him at the Beatles Fest, I said, Bruce, you got to do a tour book. And he said, you know, Chuck, it's just I'm doing too many other things. I don't know if I can get around to it. And I was waiting. I thought, you know what? I'm going to do the tour book. I mean, that's my favorite era of Beatles history. I also have a master's in history, and so I thought, I'm just going to tackle it myself. So, wow, I didn't realize it, though, when I got into it. I started 8 years ago, and trying to find the information was just monumental in all aspects, not only the photos, but the memorabilia, plus the story, you know, the backstage story of what happened during the tours.
And that's actually really interesting because, first of all, you give more than just the dates. You give supporting acts and everything, and we'll get into that. But you give so much insight as to what was said backstage. You know, I don't know how one would know unless you really do the research and look at itineraries and teen magazines. How do you begin that process?
Well, it's just that. You have to, you know, as a historian, you have to go to the primary resources first. And it's the same thing that Bruce does. It's the same thing that Mark Lewison does. You have to go to the publications of the day, you know, the teen magazines, the newspapers of the day, anything that was written back then. And even back then, there were some things that obviously the reporters got wrong, especially like song lists or some set lists. You know, they would get the song wrong or something like that. So luckily, you had fans that wrote songs down in their programs, the running order of the songs, and sometimes even they got it wrong because the Beatles were so new to them. So, yeah, that's where you started, was the primary resources.
And by the way, there was a poster the Capitol put out that had incorrect dates. If I remember right.
Yeah, exactly.
So you think they would have known. But,
come on, there's a shot of a promo poster that Chuck reprints in the book that switches John and George's heads.
Yeah. Anyway.
Yeah. Wow. But
yeah, that was Milwaukee. And the same promoter for the next night, which was Franklin Pride of Triangle Productions for Chicago. And luckily, they got it right in Chicago. But Milwaukee, they had the heads.
Well, let's get into that. You know, most people think, wow, the Beatles toured America for so long and they were here forever. And you say in the book, they were here on American soil, you know, other than personal stuff, 90 days touring. That's it. And
yeah, as a group, just 90 days. That, you know, a lot of people think they were here all the time. But as a group, just 90 days.
Very odd. Now, let's talk about Norman Weiss, because we all know about Nat Weiss, and there's a difference there. But Norman Weiss got involved really before the Beatles were on. Ed Sullivan even, didn't he?
Yeah, Norman Weiss was the vice president of General Artists Corporation. They were a New York-based talent agency that Buddy Howe owned. And Norman happened to meet, now here we go again, guys. Are we going Epstein or Epstein? I mean,
Whichever one you want.
Epstein.
Let's go Epstein, and I know we're definitely going to make...
Vivek listening? I mean,
Vivek, we're sorry, Vivek, we know it's Epstein, but you know what? For this show, we're going with Stein.
There we go.
Okay, so maybe we can just call him Epi for the...
Sounds good. Epi is good.
Yeah. So Norman Weiss went over to Paris when the Beatles were doing the residency at the Olympia, and he happened to meet Epi. And basically, you know, he said, hey, you've got something here, you know, and when if and when you come back to America, you know, I'd love to promote you guys. So Epi kind of did one of those things, kind of those handshake deals that he always did, and he said, we'll look you up when we come back. So certainly enough, in the early spring of 1964, when Brian wanted to come back to America to do the tour, he rang up Norman Weiss to help him do it.
You talk about GAC. Now, there are promoters in each city. Now, are they dealing directly with GAC or are they dealing with Brian Epstein? I was not confused by that, but I was trying to figure out why GAC was there if they're dealing directly with Brian Epstein.
GAC, being the New York-based talent agency, they kind of had the pulse on venues and, you know, they represented lots of artists. You know, they would help their managers book venues. So GAC, working out of New York, had agents spread throughout the country. They had them in New York and in L.A. and Chicago. So, you know, these people would represent then the promoters who would say, you know, we want the Beatles at Cincinnati Gardens or we want the Beatles at Dallas Memorial Coliseum. So they would put in offers to GAC. GAC then, in turn, would make out a list to Brian and say, okay, here you go. Here's the people that are interested in booking the band. So you select what you would like to do.
Right. Now, in the book, there's a lot of contracts from GAC. Where'd you get these? It's amazing that these would still exist.
Yeah. a secret source. How is that?
That's good.
Oh, some collector who doesn't want to be known.
Deep throat.
Yeah, it's one of those things where, you know, I'm bouncing along in the book, doing the research and everything, and then I get a call one mysterious day, and you know, I have all these documents, I have contracts, and so I asked him, I go, you know, I'm doing this book, it's really going to be the quintessential book on the North American tours, you know, could I feature them in the book? And he said, you know, if the book's good quality, it would be great to have them. And so we struck up a deal, and so a lot of those, not every contract is featured, obviously, just for boredom's sake, but some of the shows that were significant, I definitely wanted to show the contract. And especially some of the correspondence between Brian and GAC and Norman Weiss and things like that.
Yeah, that's great.
You know, one thing about it, Chuck, is that you haven't seen so many books in standard printing style that try to reproduce things. Because of the paper quality, the photo quality of Some Fun Tonight, it's just brilliant to see all this work reproduced. You know, when you see those sort of the scrapbooks that you see sold where they put in, you know, small pieces of memorabilia that relate to an artist. They've done them on Lennon. They've done them on Johnny Cash. They've done a bunch of them. It's nice to see the pieces and pull them out and see the reproductions. But this just brings everything together. It was reminiscent of, I remember when you opened up the Who Live at Leeds album and you had all the goodies that came with it and the contracts and things like that. But you sort of don't realize, or certain fans may not realize, that it really all is such a huge part of the live touring experience. I mean, the money was obviously was major in what they were doing. What were some of the things that fascinated you about the financial aspect of what happened during the tours?
Yeah, well, before I answer that question, I wanted to answer your first question, and that was like kind of the printing and how I wanted to present the book. And, you know, I was inspired by the Genesis books and the great quality they are. I'm always not inspired by their price and what they want for them.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
But, you know, first and foremost, I'm a Beatles fan, and so I really wanted where people could actually read the contracts, they could read the fine print, they could read a tour rider. I presented them really large in the book, and some of these contracts took up an entire page.
Mm-hmm.
So people could actually read everything on them, you know, and we did that with the extra thick paper and the spot varnish on all the images. So
Yeah. That's
the answer to your first question. The second question was the money, and you're right. I mean, money was huge. I mean, tour advances exceeding over $1 million. I mean, no one even approached that. Not even the biggest stars of the day in America, like Frank Sinatra, Judy Garland, Liza Minnelli. I mean, they were shocked. And when Brian came back to the States, when I was interviewing Tony Barrow a long time ago, he said, Chuck, when they came back to the States, you know, Brian had wanted to find out what the top stars of the day were making there. And when he heard that, he said, when we go to GAC, we're going to ask for double, which I think that's pretty
ballsy
of Brian to do that. And he got it. And he had offers waiting in the wings of people that couldn't get on the tour.
Wow. And you know, it's interesting, too, that the 64 tour, you bring out a great point. There was one particular venue, one promoter that went to offer to pay them a flat fee.
Yeah, there was a couple flat fees on the 64 tour. One was Jacksonville, which they got a great deal. It was $50,000 on a flat fee. And the other was, of course, Charlie Finley. And I don't think I need to go into the story. I think you really cater to the Beatle fan that knows a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And we all know that Charlie paid $150,000 to get the Beatles to Kansas City because Kansas City wasn't on the schedule. And Charlie had teenage daughters, and Charlie thought he could also promote the baseball team on the back of the ticket, so he amped up $150,000 as a new entertainment record.
Wow.
At that time for an advance.
And he actually ripped up the other check for $100,000 once he
saw
what was going on.
Yeah, he had approached Brian several times, and he had offered. There's a couple differing accounts on the story, one from Charlie Finley himself, who's now dead, and luckily he was interviewed many years ago by Jamie Leasing. So I took that interview, and there's been other interviews as well from people that were in the know at GAC. A lot of times you'll find in my book where I kind of present both sides of the story. There's another one about Bob Eubanks and the Dodger Stadium when they were trying to get out of the stadium. There's a couple varying accounts of there. So I present both of them, let the reader decide what they think is the better story.
Sure. Yes.
And just to explain to our listeners briefly, the whole idea of that flat fee versus the back end being that our promoters would have had the option of essentially giving the Beatles a guarantee versus a percentage of the house. And,
well, they would get a guarantee plus
right,
a percentage
right,
of the house.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, I said exactly. Versus. Yeah. No. Yeah. Thank you, Chuck. Yeah, no. Plus the percentage. So when you can offer a flat fee, as a promoter, you're, quote, taking a gamble, but this was the frickin' Beatles. There really wasn't a lot of major gambling. So that $50,000 flat fee actually was a good deal.
Exactly, yeah, because they wanted another show at the Indianapolis State Fair. They'd only booked one, and the fair board was just begging GAC for another show, and they just wouldn't give it until they finally said, okay, well, if we can get a second show, we'll offer you the guarantee plus 80% of the gross.
Wow. 80. Good God.
One more thing about the Kansas City show. It was the first time they played a stadium. We always think of Shea Stadium, but they actually played in a municipal stadium in Kansas City, and they didn't sell it out. You know, it's 40,000 seats. I saw that thing with 20,000, you said. Besides that big payment that Charles O. Finley gave them, it was a stadium show. So it's just
something it was. Actually, the first stadium show they did in North America was at Empire Stadium in Vancouver, which was not a sellout.
Right.
And then, of course, they did Kansas City Municipal Stadium, which had about 45,000 seats at the time. And then they did the Jacksonville Gator Bowl as well, that tour. But really, when you talk stadium, you always go back to Shea Stadium. I mean, when you get into Shea Stadium, that's the ushering in of the modern outdoor rock concert.
Well, you know, two things. First of all, Shea was considered originally for 64, wasn't it?
Yeah, that was one of the revelations I made in the book. I mean, I'm going through these documents from GAC that went forth between Norman and Brian. And in 1964, he gave them a huge selection of venues to choose from. And if you look at the documents which are featured in the book, you'll see Brian's handwriting on the documents of what venues he wanted and which venues he didn't want. And so I'm previewing these things, and I, you know, flip the pages and all that, and I see Shea Stadium, September 13th, 1964, and I thought, wow, I mean, because I know I've talked to Sid several times, you know, and actually, I talked to him before he died, and I know his mind was not quite as well as it's been.
Right.
And I asked him, I said, you know, were you involved in any type of negotiations in 1964 with GAC for Shea? And he goes, no, I just wasn't. So I can only conclude that perhaps Ron Delsner might have been involved in that, try to get him there, or some other New York promoter, but that was a huge shock to me. And to Brian's credit, you know, and I bring this out in the book, is that, you know, in 1964, Brian was given so many opportunities to present the Beatles at very, very large venues, you know, Tiger Stadium, Fenway Park. He even had an offer from the L.A. Coliseum that held 80,000 people. You know, and to Brian's credit, he selected venues that were more reasonably sized, you know, outdoor amphitheaters, arenas, different things like that, which held an average of about 17,000 people. I mean, Brian could have been like one of those managers we all know, you know, in the Ruddles.
Yeah, exactly.
Manager wanted every dime extracted from his artist.
Yeah.
And instead, he decided, I'm gonna pick these smaller venues because they're going to be completely filled up, which in turn is going to create a pent-up demand. So when we come back in 65, I can book larger venues and fill them up.
Well, you know, you mentioned artists, and the Beatles on the 64 tour had some really cool supporting acts, but I want to talk about one venue because it encompasses a bunch of things. One venue, Forest Hills, New York. A few things happened. There was the event with Ringo and the St. Christopher Medal. There was the meeting of the Beatles and Dylan and Aronowitz. And also, the Righteous Brothers got a little mad at Forest Hills, didn't they?
They did.
So can we talk a little bit about those three things?
Yeah, definitely. So the first one was obviously the St. Christopher's Medal with Angie McGowan. And so, you know, they come into the Delmonico, and there's a big mess up with that. And, you know, I'm sure every girl in New York was trying to call the radio station saying, I have the St. Christopher's Medal. So,
yeah.
You know, there had to be a lot of determination as to who really had it. And then finally, she got the famous meeting with him and got to kiss him. And that was great and all done in photos.
Yeah.
Well, if we could just explain the backstory on that a little bit for listeners who may not know on the St. Christopher Medal.
Well, the St. Christopher Medal was one of, it's kind of like Ringo's, what, good luck charm kind of thing. And he's had it for a while. And it was really special to him. So he wanted that thing back. And luckily, Angie gave it up.
Yeah, it was ripped off of him while he was going through a crowd, wasn't it?
Yeah, completely ripped off, you know, and a few other things were ripped off when Beatles were going through the crowd. I mean, if you look at the footage from Las Vegas when they came into that venue back into the Sahara Hotel, I mean, the crowd control was just nuts. I mean, basically, girls could have easily just gone in and just ripped off anything they wanted, clothing and pieces of hair. And so this was a common occurrence, you know, when the Beatles arrived at hotels, you know, was crowd control. It had to be done with almost military precision, you know, to get them into places. So that was the first thing. You know, of course, the Dylan meeting, I mean, it's been written about so many times.
Right.
I mean, I didn't go too much into it in the book.
No, but it is important.
Yeah, it is important. Exactly. It's a pivotal point in history of the Beatles' career. But I think one of the things I love that I found when I was doing the photo research, that I was going through a series of photos at Forest Hills, and here was this photo of Bob Dylan outside the Delmonico that night.
Wow.
And he's got like his hand under his shirt. It's featured in the book. Of course, we all know what's there, but I mean, there it is. I mean, it's that night. He's outside the Delmonico about ready to go inside to meet the Beatles, which would change their musical direction or inspire their musical direction and of course, their heads and all that. So that's the Dylan thing, which I talked about in the book. And then The other thing about Forest Hills was the Righteous Brothers. First of all, the Beatles had kind of a hard time getting over to Forest Hills, and actually it was Norman Weiss and Brian. They kind of had this epiphany. They thought, how are we ever going to get these guys over to Forest Hills from Manhattan? Because you have to go
Long Island Railroad.
I mean, is this the, you have to go through the Midtown Tunnel, correct?
You can. That's one way.
Sure.
That's one way.
Yeah. They were thinking like, well, we may never get them through the tunnel. They may be clogged with fans because one of the habits that fans had was that they used to chase the limousines, you know, and try to get close to them and all that. So they thought, gosh, in New York traffic, I mean, trying to get over to Queens is going to be tough. So what they did is they chartered a helicopter. So they got them out of the Delmonico. They went over to the Wall Street heliport. Got them onto the helicopter, and they fly them over to Forest Hills. Well, the Righteous Brothers were obviously a great act. I mean, a beautiful duo, you know, great harmonies. And they're doing great because the tour starts on the West Coast, and the Righteous Brothers are really well-known on the West Coast. You know, they had a big hit with Little Latin Loopy Lou, and it was before their major hits, but they were well-known. And so as the tour swung east of the Rockies into Cincinnati and then on to New York, the fans weren't really familiar with the Righteous Brothers. And every time they did get on stage, even on the West Coast, there would be these chants of, you know, we want the Beatles, we want the Beatles. Hmm. They were kind of sick of it. So they're on stage performing at Forest Hills, and all of a sudden this helicopter comes flying over the stage while they're on stage. And so you can imagine that not only did the chants of We Want the Beatles get higher and higher in decibel range, but also there was thousands of Brownie cameras pointing upward, shooting pictures of the Beatles helicopter flying over. And they basically had had enough at that time. And so after the shows at Forest Hills, they went back to Brian Epstein, and said, listen, you know, we're making a little more money on the West Coast with one-night stands, and is there a possibility you could let us off the tour? And Brian, being the gracious man that he was, he said, yeah, that's no problem. We'll let you off. You can just finish up at New Jersey tomorrow night, you know, at Convention Hall. We will replace you, and you can go back to the West Coast. So GAC had to scramble a little bit after that because they had to find someone. And luckily, one of the agents of GAC, his name was Bob Astor, he managed a guy in New Orleans by the name of Clarence Frogman Henry. So he started on the tour in Philadelphia on the 2nd of September, and then he finished the tour out in Dallas.
You know, it's funny because that story is so reminiscent of a few years later, I think at the same venue, Forest Hills, where the
Jimi Hendrix and Jimi Hendrix did the exact same thing.
So it was kind of weird. Yeah. And maybe it was a Forest
Only
Hills.
Only I would think that the Righteous Brothers probably didn't flip the kids the bird.
Well, yeah. And throw his guitar to the audience.
And say, you've all lost that love and feeling, so go to hell. So.
Yeah, even though the song wasn't released, we all know in Anthology, George said, you know, first of all, the Righteous Brothers had righteous indignation.
Yes.
And secondly, they had definitely lost that loving feeling.
One thing, too, I mean, we're talking about the Righteous Brothers, but Chuck, I have to say that was something that I so appreciate about the book is the fact that you really give the props to some of these great opening acts. I mean, you have the Exciters who have been kind of lost to history in a way, but Tell Him was an amazing single. And you had Jackie DeShannon, and I mean, just really fine songwriters. And it wasn't really a throwaway bill. You know, it wasn't just taking up time before the Beatles come out. I think Brian actually put some thought into who he was going to bring out with the guys, you know, on each of the tours.
Yeah, exactly. And 64 was no exception. I mean, the Bill Black combo was amazing. I mean, sadly, Bill Black couldn't go on tour because he was sick at that time, and he actually passed away the next year. He was replaced on bass by Reggie Coleman. So, you know, the Bill Black combo was awesome. He had a great beat, kind of an instrumental group, you know.
Yeah.
They would come out, do their thing, you know, and then they would stay on stage to back up these other support acts. So then you'd have the Exciters come out, which, like you said, they had a huge hit with Tell 'Em. State the book about them possibly changing the musical direction of Dusty Springfield with that hit.
Yeah.
So they came out. I talk about an interesting experience in Denver with the Exciters and what happened there. And after that, you had the Righteous Brothers, which no slouch act, you know, they came out and did their thing. And of course, you had the very sexy, hip-shaking Jackie DeShannon come out. You know, they did struggle, though, let's face it. I mean, when they came out, I mean, the fans were there to see the Beatles. So they did have to kind of weather through these support acts, and they probably didn't give them the support and applause that they should have deserved. Yeah.
That's an unenviable position, really.
Exactly. Exactly.
Chuck, on the back of the 64 Volume 1 book, there's a great picture of the Beatles in the limousine with really, I don't want to say disgusted faces on, because it's the wrong term, but weary, I guess. Is there a story on this picture? It's just a... you don't normally see them in the limousine like this.
With their guitar.
A really strange picture,
with their guitar.
That's a Kurt Gunther photo. And luckily I was able to use a few photos from Kurt's archive. Kurt's now passed away. His son runs the archive. And believe it or not, guys, there's still, he says, he estimates over 3,000 photos that are unpublished from that 64 tour.
Wow.
Yeah, I know. It makes me salivate every time I think of it.
Yeah.
But there was a couple venues the Beatles played where they had the press conference, and where they played in the venue was like basically right next door. And actually there's some film footage of this as well, of them in Chicago and in Boston, where they're clutching their instruments and they're getting into a limousine. And I'm like, what is going on here? I mean, it's not before the concert because they're not sweaty and, you know, that hair tossle, things like that. It's actually, it's before the concert. And the only thing I can figure out is that they got into these limousines so they could go into the venues through the freight entrance, you know, because they would have to bring in heavy equipment and, you know, to do circuses and different things like that at these venues. And I think it just kind of boggles the mind, though. So they must have just got out of the limousine and bounded on stage, you know, because other venues, Mal had already set up the instruments. They were kind of ready to go. But a lot of venues, they just kind of bounded on stage with their instruments. They had to do a quick tuning, and they were off and running.
And we are talking with Chuck Gunderson, author of Some Fun Tonight, the backstage story of how the Beatles rocked America, the historic tours 1964 to 1966. And we are going to take a break, and we will be right back talking about 1965 and 1966.
Well, I still have a few things to say about 64.
No.
Hi, everyone. Just wanted to let you know that besides Fab Four Free For All, each of the three of us are involved in our own individual projects. Mitch Axelrod's two books, Beatletoons, the only book about the cartoon Beatles show, and Little Billy and Baseball Bob, can be found through all of your good booksellers online, including Amazon.com, or if you'd like autographed copies, contact Mitch on Facebook.
And my buddy Rob Leonard has a great Beatles show that he's been doing for 20 years called Beatles Songs. And it's on every Friday night from 8 p.m. to 11 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And you can listen to it online. It's streaming at www.ncc.edu/WHPC. And also look for it on tunein.com.
And Tony Trucuardo is the host of 4F, Free Format for Free, on WCWP 88.1 on Long Island. He's on every Monday from 7 p.m. to 9 p.m. Eastern Time. And also at www.wcwp.org. Also available on tunein.com.
And we are back speaking with author Chuck Gunderson, who has put together an incredibly beautiful book or books on the Beatles tours called Some Fun Tonight, the backstage story of how the Beatles rocked America, the historic tours 1964 to 1966. We've been covering 1964. We want to finish up with a little bit of 1964 and go on to the story because, you know, the one thing we love about this, we normally don't go chronologically, but with these books, the story from 64 to 66.
Oh, there's changes.
There are many changes, and it is a logical progression. So let's just go a little bit more. I know you guys had a little more. Well,
my question about the book is, did you think of breaking this into three parts? You talk about Spicer as your mentor. He split the Capitol albums with the Capitol singles, and he could have made that one book, but he made it into two. I was wondering, just for presentation's sake, was that maybe a thought process in how to present the book? Because, like we've all said, these are huge books. I was wondering if you thought about that, and maybe releasing them at a staggered rate, the way Bruce. I was wondering if that was part of, at one point, of your plan.
Yeah, I had thought so much about how to do this. You know, I thought, yeah, let's just do 64, we'll release it, see how it goes, and 65, we'll release it, see how it goes, same thing with 66. But then I thought, you know what, I want to have, like, it in one place, you know, all together in a slipcase where people could come and buy it, they get the whole comprehensive history, because if you look at it, the 64 tour, you know, they had, 32 shows. So 65, they had 16 shows, and 66, they had 19 shows.
Right.
So, you know, 32 shows, obviously 64 is the largest, longest tour they did.
Right.
But if you combine the other two, 65, 66, you get about the same number. So I thought, let's just do two volumes. We'll put it in a slipcase. And eventually, you know, the book originated with just one volume. And when I went down, I started going to some of the, you know, the layout. It's self-published by me because I didn't want to edit anything out. So, you know, I'd go down to the layout meetings and talk to the people, and they'd lay it out on this coffee table. It was a husband and wife team that put this together. Awesome to work with. And I'd say, well, what about this picture? What about this piece of memorabilia? It's got to be in there. And they're all, Chuck, you're not going to fit everything in one book. And I said, okay, well, I guess we're doing two volumes then.
Well, thank goodness.
Yeah, that was a good decision, really. Yeah. Really, really was. We mentioned some of the different venues, but a couple of fascinating points about the Vegas show in 64. I had never realized that it was the Vegas Convention Center that was the source of the Capitol Picture sleeves, which
was
cool.
Yeah, the Vegas show, that's correct. That's those photos were taken there. And Vegas, I always say, was a very curious stop on the 1964 tour.
Right.
Because Vegas isn't the city that we know of today. You know, the big bustling, you know, strip, and there's tons of resort properties and casinos and things like that. 1964, Vegas, the city, only had 65,000 people living there.
Wow.
And if you threw in surrounding Clark County, it added about another 60,000 people. So you got about 120,000 people living there. The average stop on the tour for 1964 population-wise was 1.4 million people. So if you take out even New York, Chicago, L.A., you're still at about 800,000. So why did the Beatles want to go to Vegas and perform in Vegas? And the simple reason or answer I found to that question after talking to a lot of people about that was simply the Beatles and Brian wanted to see Las Vegas. John was fascinated by these casinos in the middle of the desert, and they really wanted to see it. And I really think they had the mistaken identity that in Vegas, because it was smaller, that they could maybe lounge around the pool, they could play in the casino, and it was anything but that. They basically saw the airport, the Sahara Hotel, the convention center, back to the hotel and back to the airport, and they were off to Seattle.
But we'll leave it a mystery, and I'm just going to say that the powers that be at Vegas arranged to have something brought into the Beatles' bedroom that no other venue ever would have, and for no other artist that they ever did after.
Yeah, spot machines.
There you go. Oh, see, I was going to leave it the element of mystery. You would have had it by the book. I would have thought people would have think it was something pornographical or something like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, exactly. It's crazy because it's slot machine, even today, like, you know, Nevada is run by the powerful Nevada Gaming Commission, and they would not allow any type. They would not allow any gaming devices today, even for the highest of rollers or the biggest of entertainment stars that play there today. So,
never.
Sorry, Celine, you're not getting slot machines.
Yeah, but you know, speaking of pornographic, there's a good lead in there. It didn't have to do with Vegas, but talk about John and the Twins.
Yeah, well, you know, that was one of those stories where you gotta kind of take it with a grain of salt. So, you know, I kind of researched Derek's book, who mentioned a certain thing that happened, and eyewitnesses that were there that I interviewed, and the whole issue with the two underage girls in John's room, and then there was a blackmail plot by the mother, and there possibly might have been a secret $10,000 payoff, and I kind of, in the book, loosely kind of string all the events together, and I really want to let the reader decide what
right.
they think happened.
Sure.
Because
sure.
I wasn't there, and I'm not going to say something that didn't happen.
Yeah,
right.
No, that's definitely the way to go. I mean, John always talks about the fact that the tours, how did he describe it? It was almost like Fellini.
Yeah,
but you don't really get that. you know, in the book, you do get that it was really about going out there and making music. And obviously, we, as we said, money and finance. But I think it was overstated in a way, it seems.
Yeah, I didn't go there. I mean, I didn't go for the salacious material that could have happened on tour. I mean, I wasn't there. I don't know. I mean, why should I say these things? And I know there's other books that have been written about it, but there's just so much other information that needed to be written about the tours.
Yes.
You know, that actually happened. So why not bring all of that out and leave the rest to imagination?
You got that great shot of Mary Smith on stage at Forest Hills, which I don't think I had ever seen anywhere. That was great.
Actually. Yeah, and actually, when I interviewed Mary, and she gave me her whole story, she actually said, "Chuck, it's not my real name, and I don't want to use my real name, and so you're going to have to say Mary Smith." So
that's
actually someone else.
But you know, so let's move on to 65 and 6, because now the Beatles are a little more road weary, but they're playing, you know, well, I'm not saying bigger venues, but they were selling out now. In 65, you know, you got Shea, you got Atlanta, hot and muggy, and legal battles between towns. And so let's go on to a little bit of 65, you know. What was happening there? I know it was Norman Weiss again with Epi.
Yeah, so Norman came back again, you know, and this, you know, Epi came back again in the early spring of 65 and said, we're going to do this again. So they, again, planned another tour. And, of course, with the demand, they decided, let's try to do bigger venues, and which they did. And if they did an arena like the Cow Palace or Maple Leaf Gardens, they're going to do two shows this time. They're not going to do just one show. So they started booking that. And so, yes, I mean, Shea Stadium, obviously the granddaddy of them all. I mean, 55,600 people. I mean, just amazing. Every seat full. And not every stadium was sold out. Atlanta especially. You know, that was a brand new ballpark. Atlanta Stadium was 55,000 seats it could hold. There was 32,000 people there. And that is my conclusion as to why the Beatles sounded great in Atlanta. It wasn't because of feedback monitors, because there were no feedback monitors on stage in Atlanta, despite this myth perpetuating on and on and on. We finally found photos of them on stage in Atlanta, and there is no any feedback monitors. And so my conclusion was that they had played Shea Stadium, you know, 55,600 people. I mean, you can imagine the decibels and the noise in that concert. They then travel to Toronto, where they do two shows at Maple Leaf Gardens, which Maple Leaf Gardens is one of the oldest arenas in North America. The sound system must have just been horrible.
Right.
So then they get to Atlanta. And they get to Atlanta, and that stadium had just been built, so the stadium public address system was the newest of its kind, you know, in terms of sound technology. And only 32,000 people show up to a 55,000-seat venue, so there's a lot of dead air there.
20,000 less
screen. And finally, the Beatles notice it. You know, they say, hey, we can hear.
Yes, 20,000 less screams per, you know.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But, yeah, and there's other venues, obviously, that weren't sold out. You know, Balboa Stadium in San Diego, you know, it was not sold out. And but most of the arena shows were, you know, you got the Cow Palace, you know, completely sold out. Sam Houston Coliseum sold out. So they did really well. They made even more money in 65 than they did in 64. And they did basically only half the shows they did in 64. They only did 16 shows in 65 compared to 32 in 64.
Let's get back to Atlanta, because they always call it Hotlanta. And you do go into the story about, and you actually have pictures of, you know, the hot and mugginess of that show.
Yeah, well, it's the Deep South in Atlanta. But, you know, the Beatles, they had already experienced this in America before, touring, you know, in the summers in North America, which can be quite hot. You know, going back to 64, Cincinnati Gardens was just packed to the gills with people. I mean, they put seats where seats shouldn't have been, probably to the watches of a nervous fire marshal. You know, and air conditioning back then in Cincinnati Gardens, you know, this is an arena that was built, you know, a long time ago. So it was really hot. It was probably over 100 degrees on stage. You know, and Atlanta's the same way. I mean, Atlanta's not a great place to be in August, you know, in that summer sweltering heat. And there's a story of the Beatles wanting, you know, some fans down there, and actually Ringo wanting a hairdryer, which the promoter thought, this is the strangest request I ever heard. I mean, what man in 1965 would request a hairdryer?
Well, a man that wanted to open a string of hair salons.
Exactly. So they had to scurry up a hairdryer from somewhere.
Well, speaking about the weather in Atlanta, why don't we talk a bit, Chuck, about Winky the Weather Bunny?
One of my favorite stories in the book. So 1965, the Beatles play at White Sox Park. They had played at the International Amphitheater the year before. So they said, hey, let's do two shows at White Sox Park. So they roll into town. They're staying at this hotel called the Sahara O'Hare, which is basically owned by a mobster, Manny Scar, who eventually was killed a couple weeks later after the Beatles left because of some gambling debt.
Wow.
Yeah, so they go and they do the press conference, and there's this beautiful girl that walks into the press conference, and she's wearing a tennis outfit. And her name is Edwina Rast, but on WLS, she goes by the nickname of Winky the Weather Bunny. So she is basically the weather girl, which in today, 2014, you could never get away with.
No.
So Winky comes to the press conference, and immediately George Harrison starts sizing her up. I mean, you know, this girl really catches his attention. So Winky kind of sits near George, and they're chatting it up.
Winky to Winky, of course.
Yeah, Winky's giving the Winky, or George is giving the Winky to the Winky. So anyways, he starts talking with her and says, you know, you don't need to leave so quick, you know. And she goes, well, I have this appointment I got to go to, and, you know, I got to get out of here. And he said, well, you can stay and talk for a while. And she goes, nope, I'm not. I'm leaving. So she gets up, and she leaves, much to George's dismay. Well, the night of the concert, which they already performed the afternoon show, Winky decides to get tickets. She calls Clark Weber from WLS and says, you know, can you get me some tickets for me and my boyfriend?
Yeah.
So Winky got tickets, but she got field admission. So she went down, and there's a photo in the book that I found, which I just love. It's Winky standing there in a black cocktail dress, and George is on stage playing, looking over at her, and Winky's just kind of talking away to Clark Weber.
Yeah,
that's great.
I'm sorry, but Winky knew what she was doing.
Well, that's what's interesting is I talked to Clark a couple years ago, and he said, you know, have you seen Edwina lately? And I said, no, I haven't. She goes, well, she lives down in Texas, and she's not Winky the Weather Bunny anymore. She has, like, put on a lot of weight.
I can't even.
No comment.
Yeah.
Sticking with 65 and some of the incidents that happened, the Minnesota show, the town fathers didn't want the Beatles there anymore after the Minnesota show, apparently.
Yeah, well, it's more the police department. So the Beatles had played Minnesota on August 21st at the old Met Stadium, which, again, was not sold out even there. So after the show, they go back to the Leamington Motor Lodge, which that was a really curious choice that I found out. I actually found out that there was two Leamington. I don't know if it's pronounced Leamington or Leamington, but for this sake, it's Leamington. So there was two Leamington hotels in Minneapolis. They're about four blocks apart. There was one Leamington, which was a high-rise. It was a nice, really nice hotel. And then there was the Leamington Motor Lodge, which was about five stories. And the Beatles actually stayed there, which was really curious to me.
Had hourly rates.
Yeah, the better rates. I don't know. Effie was trying to save some money. I don't know what was going on. So they actually stayed there. And that hotel actually became a center for indigent people, and then it was later destroyed and made into a parking garage. But, you know, it was just crazy. And so, you know, here they are. I mean, 1965, guys, they're in the midst of international superstars.
Sure, sure.
And they're staying at this little podunk motor lodge. So it's kind of open, and the fans are pretty much can get to them. You know, it's very accessible. So there was probably a large party in the room and things like that. And then finally the police got wind of it, and they came over there and busted it up. And Sergeant Dwyer, he just went on a rant. I mean, when they left, you know, I guess the Beatles were a little curt, the entourage. You know, they said, hey, look, we're the Beatles. You know, we're having a party. Leave us alone. And so Dwyer the next day just got on a rant and said, you know, these guys are basically a circus troupe passing through. You know, they're not welcome into our town anymore. We could care less if they ever come back to our town. And as a matter of fact, they never did come back to Minneapolis. That was it. So, yeah, they were not very happy there.
Wow.
Chuck, one of the things about the 3 years of touring is, you know, how much was recorded film-wise, tape-wise, and how much wasn't. We know Shea Stadium was filmed, and we know Washington, D.C. was filmed, but there wasn't a lot of recording, at least legal, of any of these shows. Did the Beatles not want to record? I mean, they did Shea Stadium, but they didn't do anything in 66, at least for America. They did Tokyo, but they didn't do anything in America. Was there any reason why they weren't recording some of these, you know, historic events?
I think Brian was really protective of the Beatles and their images and what was out on them. And there's a famous story, and if you go back to 64 in Jacksonville, where there was a LA film crew that was kind of following them around. And Derek Taylor was, you know, knew who they were, and Brian knew who they were, and they were getting upset that these guys were trying to film them. So the Beatles were about to come on stage in Jacksonville, and there was these cameramen ready to shoot, and Derek actually had to come out and said, we're not going to start the concert until these guys pack up and leave. So they kind of, you know, had to deal with that first. But then there was also the regular local news crew that were there. Like, if you look at a photo, it's not printed in the book, but I have another photo of stage shot in Las Vegas. It may be printed in the book, but there's a guy, like, right in front of the stage with a movie camera filming this concert. Well, I'm trying to think, well, where is this thing? I've never seen it. There's hardly any footage from Las Vegas in a lot of these shows. So there's bits and pieces strewn all over the place. And I guess when the Ron Howard thing gets done, if it ever gets done, that maybe we'll start to see this stuff for the first time. And, you know, the recordings are the same way. It's bits and pieces, you know. And every year we hear a story of Beatle tape surfacing, you know, of the Toronto show or something. Someone called me the other day. Said that he had the entire Toronto show from 66, including the opening act. So I would love to hear that.
Wow.
I do want to get to 1966 because it becomes a really different story here. But in 65, they had a few days off, which was unusual, like 5 or 6 days, I believe. And at that time, they went and met Elvis.
Yeah, well, they part of the tour, you know, I know these things were just log jammed. I mean, it was just city to city, you know, here, you know, press conference, concerts, everything. But whenever they went out to did the West Coast wing, you know, they would always stay a few days in L.A. They did in 64, they did in 65, and they did in 66. And no hotel would have them in L.A., so they always rented a, you know, a larger home that they stayed at. So in 1965, when they were there, they decided that, you know, there were some arrangements made, and Elvis was in town. He was filming and doing different things, and of course, they want to meet Elvis. And so on the 27th of August, they decided to make the historic meeting. Brian and Colonel Parker were very adamant that no cameras were there, no recording devices of any type. So, you know, I mean, we hear what happened from the Memphis Mafia, some of the Beatles themselves, what happened in there. But what happened in there is what happened in there, and we have to believe their stories. So there's just a very few scant pictures of them leaving that night on the 27th, leaving Elvis. And the next night, they're in San Diego playing another show.
So let's get to 66, because now the happy-go-lucky Beatles are under fire a little bit because of John's remarks from March of 66. We all know what those remarks were. So, you know, there's a lot more tension on the tour, less sellouts. Why don't we get into...
And some very weary-looking photographs, man. I mean, again, Chuck, I can't stress enough how beautiful the photo work is in the book, but by the time you do get to 66, some of the portraits... Yeah, there's loneliness in some of those portraits and some of those shots. Really, like, interesting perspective, but...
Yeah, well, 66, you know, started off really great. I mean, let's face it, you know, Epstein was back in America, you know, arranging the tour for 66. He'd had a, you know, wonderful year in 65, so him and Norman, of course, got together in 66 and started planning another tour. I mean, And I don't think it was anything like, okay, well, this is the last tour. This is it. We're going to plan it. And after this, it's over. I think Brian would have done the same thing in 67 and however long he had to do it after that. So, you know, in spring, it's announced. Basically, late spring, it's announced the Beatles are coming back to America. John had made the comments back in the UK, and they were printed in the UK back in the spring, and no one even took notice to them. So things are going great. You know, the promoters are paying the money. They're excited to pay the money. They're excited to have the Beatles come to their town. Yesterday and Today gets released in June. That was kind of the first, you know...
grumbling.
grumbling. You know, like, what's up with this cover, you know, type of thing. So that was the first thing that happened. And then, of course, the Datebook thing that happened, you know, when Datebook was released. And that was early August. So the tour is like about 3 weeks away at this point. And this thing gets released. Well, I think a lot of pre-sales happened with tickets and everything, but really when the real sales happen, it's probably in early August, right before the tour starts. Stadiums prior to then were filling up. The promoters were happy and everything. And then Revolver gets released in early August. I think it got released on the 8th of August. You know, that's good. And it's like, but wow, what's this music? I mean, it's really different. I mean, these weird Indian things and it's backward music, you know, and like, what's going on here?
Tougher to play on stage.
Certainly.
Yeah, exactly. There's no way they could have done that on stage. So anyways, then everything just hit, you know. I mean, the Datebook thing just fueled it. And at that point, parents got into the act. You know, they said, there's no way you're going to go to that Beatles concert. The religious community got into the act. And all of a sudden, ticket sales just died. I mean, literally died. And here's another great thing that I love about Brian, and I'm so glad Vivek honored Brian with his book. And that is that Brian went back to some of the promoters. First of all, Brian was ready to cancel the entire tour. He had gone to New York prior to the Beatles getting there in mid-August. He had gone the first part of August to try to quiet the firestorm. And he was prepared to cancel the entire tour and return all the guarantees. But he and Norm decided to go ahead and do this, to keep it going. And some of the promoters were complaining because they, you know, especially like Busch Stadium in St. Louis, it just wasn't filling up at all. And, you know, they paid a hefty guarantee. So Brian went to the promoter there in St. Louis and he said, look, you know, you guys have been good to us and we're going to reduce the guarantee, which I think is a pretty classy act from Brian.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. And yeah. So, you know, the 66 tour kind of started out tough. You know, they had the press conference in Chicago when they got there at the Astor Towers. And John was just beside himself, and he actually talked to Tony Barrow and Brian before they went on to the press conference, and he was kind of distraught, you know, as to all this furor he had caused. But the Beatles, you know, the other three Beatles were completely on John's side. They supported John, and they went out, they did the press conference at the Astor Towers, and they actually did a couple press conferences that day, and the tour commenced, and it started.
It's interesting and funny how it's St. Louis, because correct me if I'm wrong, you don't think about St. Louis as because it's not a Bible Belt area, really. So, you know, the impact of John's statement on ticket sales was probably even really greater than we think, because you always hear about all the issues in the South with the tour, partly, I guess, because of the KKK influence and the heavy Bible Belt, but... You know, when you're saying about the effect of ticket sales in St. Louis, that's an area that doesn't hit you right away as having been affected.
Yeah,
that
and
heavily.
You would think even on the West Coast it wouldn't be a big deal. But even on the West Coast, parents were upset and ministers were upset. And when they swung through Washington, D.C. on August 15th, that was the first signs of the KKK actually showing up outside of RFK Stadium, D.C. Stadium back then it was called. You know, and protesting. But generally, each of these venues that the Beatles played at on the 66 tour, there would be youth religious groups that their minister kind of got marshaled them up to come out and hand out pamphlets. It was all peaceful. I mean, Memphis was probably, you know, the one that was the most raucous. But for the most part, it was a peaceful demonstration. But everywhere they played that summer in 66, there was some form of protest.
And the irony was that when Jesus toured a few months later, he sold out all those venues.
That's what I'm hearing.
Baboom, you know, yeah. Chick. Baboom chick.
Sorry.
Well, look at the Pope when he came back.
That's right.
But he never said he was bigger than the Beatles.
That's true. He didn't.
You know.
Chuck, if you had a chance to interview Brian Epstein, what would you ask him about how he put together the tours?
That's a great question. And
thank you.
Boy, I tell you, because when you look, especially at the 64 tour, I would just think to myself, Brian, what were you thinking? I mean, sometimes I think Brian thought North America was the shape of the UK. You know, because, you know, in the UK, if you look at their tour schedule, I mean, they're up north, they come down south, they go over east, you know, and it's all within driving distance.
Right.
You know, North America is huge. I mean, the Beatles traveled from London to London in 64. They traveled over 22,000 miles. So you look at that haphazard touring in 64, you know, they start in San Francisco, they go down to Las Vegas, they go north to Seattle, they go further north to Vancouver, they go all the way south back down to L.A. I mean, why didn't you just do like the San Francisco, Las Vegas, L.A. thing, then go north? So I guess I'd ask him that, you know, kind of what was kind of the plan there on that? And, boy, if I had him, oh, my gosh, there's a lot of questions. But I think that would be the first question I'd ask him is, you know, how did you and Norm kind of figure this thing out?
And also, why wasn't the tours longer? That'd be another question for me. You know, I know they had schedules and stuff, but as you said, the tours were very short in America.
Yeah, they were. And when they went back in 1964 back to the UK to do the autumn fall tour, that was about, I think, almost as long as the tour they had just done in America. But, you know, the venues are shorter spaced, you know. It's an easy time to get to the next venue, whereas in North America, they're getting on a plane and flying several thousand miles to get to the next venue.
You mentioned the press conferences, and you quote liberally in the book some of these press conferences. Was there any thought of including a CD of some of these press conferences? Because some of the questions that they were asked would be even funnier to hear if you actually heard the person ask them.
Exactly, yeah. In 1964 alone, they did 25 formal press conferences, which is, to me, that is professional. I mean, to come out and do those day in, day out, and as a matter of fact, over the 3 years, you know, they did 45 formal press conferences, and they did 7 press tapings. And, yeah, I would have loved to include a CD, but, oh, my gosh, you know, just trying to put the book together. You know, as a self-published author, you're just going off in a million directions.
Sure, sure.
And for me, being a Beatles fan, I think the biggest thing for me is I really wanted photos and lots of unpublished photos. I mean, that was my goal. My goal was to get photos from every city they played in North America, and luckily I accomplished that goal. But, man, the photos to me are really the
they're gold.
Beauty of that book, yeah.
Well, you know, gold. I want to wrap up, Chuck, but I want to ask you, you mentioned the photos, and that was actually going to be my last thing before the wrap-up. There's so many beautiful photos, color, black and white. I mean, just unbelievable, and as well as the memorabilia, the ads and everything. I mean, people really cannot imagine the books unless you really go see it or buy it, and you really need to have it in your hands to realize the beauty of it. But I noticed in the acknowledgments, there is a specific name from Apple. I won't give the name away, but was there any correspondence with them about this, and did they give you any feedback?
Yeah, there was. As a matter of fact, when I went and tried to use the Las Vegas photos, they're actually owned by the Las Vegas News Bureau, which is a kind of an arm of the Las Vegas Convention and Visitors Bureau. They said, Chuck, you're more than welcome to use our photo archive. The only caveat that we have is that you have to get approval from Apple. And I thought, well, okay, that's never going to happen, you know, thinking right to myself. And obviously I'm not going to be able to get these. So, okay, I got to find a contact at Apple. So I called a few friends, you know, who should I contact over there? I got a name. I emailed them on a Thursday, told them about the project, and said what I wanted to do. I literally got an email back on Monday saying to me, Chuck, we fully support this. You're more than welcome to have our permission to use the Las Vegas photos for the book. So that was the first part of the story with Apple. The second story is that, you know, obviously I sent a book to Apple, just, and I figure I'm never going to hear back. And luckily, a friend who's doing a project with Apple right now, somehow my book got mentioned or brought up, and Jeff Jones said, I love that book. That guy did an amazing job. We all love it here. So that, to me, you know, not hearing anything personally back from Apple, but hearing it through someone else just really warmed my heart. I mean, for them to like this book and support the project really means a lot to me.
Have you sent one to the guys?
Well, I have sent out a couple. I don't know if they've gotten there yet. I'm still in the process of kind of getting books into the right hands to the right people.
Right.
So I think right now Paul probably has one, and I'm working on the other three.
You mentioned the Ron Howard film. Is there any way that you could get involved in that at all?
Well, I don't know about that. All I do know is that a friend of mine who's working on the Ron Howard film, they flew him out for a meeting to L.A., and when he went into the conference room with all the people that are putting this thing together, my book was right on the conference table.
Oh, that's
excellent.
A good sign.
Definitely.
Yeah, it's a good sign, but I've never been contacted by anyone by there. So, but if they do, I'd be happy to help.
And lastly, I do have to bring this up, but you know, you said self-published, and we all know what that undertaking is like, and maybe some of us don't know. The book is just beautiful, and you know, there is a certain cost to this book, which may seem a little high, but please tell our listeners, well, the justification of the cost because of the incredible undertaking that you've done.
Yeah, well, I decided to go with the Bruce Spicer route. I mean, Bruce is a good friend of mine, great mentor. I mean, if you haven't bought Bruce's books, go buy Bruce's book, especially Coming to America, you know.
Yeah.
It's a great book because it's a seamless transfer into my book. Anyways, I just didn't want to edit anything out. I just wanted, I'm a fan, you know, that's first and foremost. And so many Beatle books I get, you know, it's the same pictures, it's the same things. And I really wanted to break the mold on that, like Bruce has done and others, by having tons of unpublished photos, by having all the memorabilia, you know, by having important contracts and documents. I remember talking to Andy Dubuque, and he said when he started his Beatles Gear book, you know, it was 800 pages or something like that. And the publisher said, well, you've got to get this down to like 300. So, you know, there's 500 pages of stuff that we don't know about from Andy's research.
Wow.
And so I decided that, hey, I'm going to do this because I want complete control over this. And so then we had to figure out a price. And I thought, well, Genesis book of this one volume, or the Ringo photograph book, I mean, it's $400 or $500.
Right.
And I don't want to charge that. I mean, that's ridiculous. And so I really tried to go with the mentality of you're buying two Bruce books, plus I'm throwing in a sleeve. So that was kind of the pricing on it. It's $160 for the two volumes. It's over 600 pages, over 600 images. And, you know, the high quality printing, the extra thick paper, the spot varnish on the photos. And then I built a really nice sleeve. So I thought, okay, well, let's try to buy two Bruce books, and I'm throwing in the sleeve. So it's $160, and then I charge $15 for shipping, which I lose every time because it's 13 pounds.
Yeah, and we might throw in the idea that this show will be up as we are starting to get into the fall and into, you guessed it, holiday gift buying season, folks.
Thank you.
So for that Beatle fan in your and in all seriousness, give this as a gift to someone. You will blow their mind. So,
well, forget about a gift for anybody else. Buy it for yourself.
For yourself. But I'm just saying, you know.
I mean, it's, you know, all kidding aside, you know, we mentioned.
It's the final statement on the tours.
Well, I think it
really
is. And there's just a beauty to these books. And then they're very big books, too. When I say, you know, heavy, I'm not talking about that. You know, size-wise, they are Bruce Spicer size books. If
right.
You've seen Bruce's books.
Right. Oversized
incredible,
hardcover.
Oversized, you know, hardcover.
Yeah.
Incredible stock. You know, the beauty of the images, it's not going to be a book that you just shove on your shelf. First of all, you have to find a shelf big enough. But,
that's true.
But, you know, these books, when you think, oh, my goodness, $175 for a Beatle book, but these are not your ordinary Beatle books. They really aren't. And
no,
I think
is,
you need to have these in your library.
And thank you for publishing it yourself. I mean, self-publishing doesn't have the stigma that obviously it used to have, starting with Bruce's books and other people's books. You know, this is fantastic.
Well, and it's a huge risk, too, to self-publish. I mean,
yes.
you know, writing and researching the book is fun and everything, but then you don't realize one day that two semi-trucks are going to show up to your house and say, where do you want these books, Chuck?
Yeah.
And then, you know, you have to find storage for them. I mean, you have to pay for the storage every month. You have to find climate-controlled storage.
Yep. Pallets.
And then I do all the fulfillment myself.
Oh, God.
Yeah, that's, yeah. I mean, people don't realize that. And believe me, I mean, this $175 is well worth it. You might think right now while you're listening, oh, well, you know, I've seen that before, but you really need to see these books, especially, you know, if you're into the touring. There is not going to be another book on the touring that
No, there's
possibly...
no reason for anyone to
right.
write it.
Right. Why bother?
And the thing about what I really enjoy about the book is that Larry Kane wrote a book about his time on the tour, and you have him doing a forward. Lewison's book, The Beatles Live, has a lot of stuff, but this
Bob Eubanks actually talks in this book,
and it's nice because every one of those folks are mentioned or are present
right.
at Barry Tashin,
right.
you know, also.
That's right, the remains guy. And your book sort of expands on everything they did,
brings it all together,
and a lot of pictures too. That's the thing I really thought was really cool. Question about the cover of the 64 book. Those are jelly beans on the stage there, right?
Yeah, they are. And actually, when I was designing or had the guys design that, the design team, I said, you know what would be kind of cool? And they said, what? And I said, if we could colorize those jelly beans on the floor there. And he said, nah, it's going to look stupid. But I still...
That would have been great.
I like that idea.
I would have liked it too. Yeah.
It would have also been more expensive, though, right?
It fell on flat ears, I guess. But I think one of the biggest compliments I've received on the book is from my friend Mark Lewis. And I mean, he's, you know, God to me. And we've been friends over the years. And I just saw him at the fest in Chicago, and we were talking. And he said, Chuck, he goes, your books, I mean, they're right up there. I mean, that book's going to be on my desk when I research, you know, the tour era.
How could it not?
You know, Chuck, you should have talked to the publisher about that idea you just had. That's a great idea.
What's
know,
that?
Coloring the jelly beans.
Coloring the jelly beans.
Should have talked to the damn publisher, Dan.
Ha ha.
You know what, Chuck?
We could even print on the jelly beans, like, I love John. I love
So we've talked enough about the book. Why don't you tell our listeners where they can get the book?
Well, just like Bruce Spizer's book, you know, I have a website up, and after you buy Bruce's The Beatles Are Coming, buy my books, go to somefuntonight.com. You can also go to Amazon and buy them. You can go to eBay and buy them.
Wow.
And that's basically the three main sources that I sell them at.
Some Fun Tonight being the lyrics of Long Tall Sally?
Wife said, you're going to have to explain that title. And I said, I don't think so. I think Beatle fans are going to get it. You
oh,
know?
You bet.
Oh, you bet.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've never had a question like, why'd you name it Some Fun Tonight?
Well,
Long Tall Sally.
Well,
exactly.
So www.somefuntonight.com for Chuck Gunderson's book, which is called Some Fun Tonight, The Backstage Story of How the Beatles Rocked America, the Historic Tours of 1964, 66, Volume 1 and Volume 2. Unbelievable. We thank you so much for doing this. We thank you for being on the show, Chuck. And obviously, we want to tell people you really need to go get these books. So thank you so much. And for this edition of Fab 4 Free for All, this has been your moderator, Mitch Axelrod. And joining me today has been
Rob Leonard
and
Tony Chiguardo.
And our special guest, Chuck Gunderson. Thank you so much, Chuck.
Yeah, thank you, guys. I mean, it's been an honor being on your show. I just think you guys are the best, and I really, really appreciate the time. Thanks.
Well, thank you so much. And so the check cleared. So
yeah.
We appreciate it, and we will talk to everybody soon. Take care.
Fab 4 Free For All was edited and produced by Tony Chiguardo at Word of Mouth Studios in Westbury, New York.
The opening and closing theme is My Dolly by the band The Badge, featuring longtime listener Jeff Slate, available on its debut album Digital Retro and recent Best Of compilation, as well as from the Fab 4 Free For All website.
Thanks for listening to Fab 4 Free For All.